So welcome to this class on English writing and composition. Again, we're going to talk about what makes compositions great. And I felt like there's nothing better than I can do than showcase great compositions. That's why I want to start with a short story. This short story is my favorite short story. In my opinion, it's probably the best short story ever written, ever will be, ever has been. I read it every year to my students, if I have new students at least, and it touches me deeply. I think students should hear it. I think, in fact, teachers could benefit from it, too. It's called The Scarlet Ibis, written by James Hirst. Just a newspaper editor, can't find a whole lot of anything he wrote except this. It was in the clove of seasons, summer was dead, but autumn had not yet been born, that the ibis slipped in the bleeding tree. The flower garden was stained with rotting brown magnolia petals, and ironweeds grew rank amid the purple phlox. The 5 o'clocks by the chimney still marked time, but the oriole's nest in the elm was untenanted and rocked back and forth like an empty cradle. The last graveyard flowers were blooming, and their smell drifted over the cotton fields and through every room of our house, speaking softly the names of our dead. It's strange that all this is still so clear to me, now that a summer has long since fled and time has had its way. A grindstone stands where the bleeding tree stood, just outside the kitchen door. And now, if an oriole sings in the elm, its song seems to die up in the leaves, a silvery dust. The flower garden is prim, the house a gleaming white, and the pale fence across the yard stands straight and spruce. But sometimes, like right now, as I sit in the cool, green-draped parlor, the grindstone begins to turn. And time, with all its change, is ground away. And I remember Doodle. Doodle was just about it, the craziest brother a boy ever had. Of course, he wasn't crazy, crazy like old Miss Leedy, who was in love with President Wilson and wrote him a letter every day, but was a nice crazy, like someone you meet in your dreams. He was born when I was 6 and was, from the outset, a disappointment. He seemed all head, with a tiny body which was red and shriveled like an old man's. Everybody thought he was going to die, everybody except Aunt Nicey, who had delivered him. Daddy had Mr. Heath, the carpenter, build a little mahogany coffin for him. But he didn't die. And when he was 3 months old, Mama and Daddy decided that they might as well name him. They named him William Armstrong, which was like tying a big tail on a small kite. Such a name sounds only good on a tombstone. I thought myself pretty smart at many things, like holding my breath, running, jumping, or climbing the vines in the old woman's swamp, and I wanted more than anything else, someone to race to Horsehead Landing, someone to box with, and someone to perch with in the top fork of the great pine behind the barn, which, across the fields and swamps, you could see the sea. I wanted a brother. But Mama, crying, told me that even if William Armstrong lived, he would never do these things with me. He might not, she sobbed, be all there. He might, as long as he lived, lie on the rubber sheet in the center of the bed in the front room, where the white curtains billowed out in the afternoon sea breeze, rustling like palmetto fronds. It was bad enough having an invalid brother, but one who possibly was not all there was unbearable. So I began to make plans to kill him by smothering him with a pillow. However, one afternoon as I watched him, my head poked between the iron posts of the foot of the bed, he looked straight at me and grinned. I skipped through the rooms, down the echoing hall, shouting, "Mama, he smiled! He's all there! He's all there!" And he was. When he was 2, if you laid him on his stomach, he began to try to move, straining terribly. The doctor said that with his weak heart, this strain would probably kill him, but it didn't. Trembling, he'd push himself up, turning first red, then a soft purple, and finally collapse back onto the bed like an old, worn-out dog. I can still see Mama watching him, her hand pressed tight across her mouth, her eyes wide and unblinking. But he learned to crawl. It was the 3rd winter, and we brought him out of the front bedroom, putting him on the rug before the fireplace. For the first time, he became one of us. As long as he lay all the time in bed, we called him William Armstrong, even though it was formal and sounded as if we were referring to one of our ancestors. But with his creeping around on the deerskin rug and beginning to talk, something had to be done about the name. It was I who renamed him. When he crawled backward, as if he were in reverse and couldn't change gears. If you called him, he'd turn around if you were going in the other direction, then he'd back right up to you to be picked up. Crawling backward making him look like a doodle bug, so I called him Doodle. And in time, Mama and Daddy thought it was a better name than William Armstrong. Only Aunt Nicey disagreed. She said babies should be treated with special respect since they might turn out to be saints. Renaming my brother was perhaps the kindest thing I ever did for him, because nobody expects much from someone called Doodle. Although Doodle learned to crawl, he showed no signs of walking, but he wasn't idle. He talked so much that we all quit listening to what he said. It was about this time that Daddy built him a go-kart, and I had to pull him around. At first, I just paraded him up and down the piazza, but then he started crying to be taken out into the yard, and it ended up by my having to lug him wherever I went. If I so much as picked up my cap, he'd start crying to go with me, and Mama would call from wherever she was, "Take Doodle with you." He was a burden in many ways. The doctor had said that he mustn't get too excited, too hot, too cold, or too tired, and that he must always be treated gently. A long list of don'ts went with him, all of which I ignored once we got out of the house. To discourage his coming with me, I'd run with him across the end of the cotton rows and careen him around corners on two wheels. Sometimes I accidentally turned him over, but he never told Mama. His skin was very sensitive, and he had to wear a big straw hat wherever he went. When the going got rough and he had to cling to the sides of the go-kart, the hat slipped all the way down over his ears. He was a sight. Finally, I could see I was licked. Doodle was my brother, and he was going to cling to me forever no matter what I did. So I dragged him across the burning cotton fields to share with him the only beauty I knew, Old Woman's Swamp. I pulled the go-kart through the sawtooth fern down to the green dimness where the palmetto fronds whispered by the stream. I lifted him out and set him down on the soft rubber grass beside the tall pine. His eyes were round with wonder as he gazed about him, and his little hands began to stroke the rubber grass. Then he began to cry. "For heaven's sake, what's the matter?" I asked, annoyed. "It's so pretty," he said. "So pretty." After that day, Doodle and I went down into Old Woman's Swamp. I would gather wild flowers, wild violets, honeysuckle, yellow jasmine, snake flowers, and water lilies, and with wire grass we'd weave them into necklaces and crowns. We'd bedeck ourselves with our handiwork and loll about thus beautified beyond the touch of the everyday world. Then, when the slanted rays of the sun burned orange in the tops of the pines, we'd drop our jewels into the stream and watch them float away toward the sea. There is within me, with sadness I've watched it in others, a knot of cruelty, born by the stream of love, much as our blood sometimes bears the seed of our destruction. And at times I was mean to Doodle. One day I took him up to the barn loft and showed him his casket, telling him that we had all believed he would die. It was covered with a film of Paris green sprinkled to kill the rats, and screech owls had built a nest inside it. Doodle studied the mahogany box for a long time and said, "It's not mine." "It is," I said. "And before I help you down from the loft, you're going to have to touch it." "I won't touch it," he said sullenly. "Then I'll leave you here by yourself," I threatened, and made as if I were going down. Doodle was frightened of being left. "Don't leave me, brother," he cried, and leaned toward the coffin. His hand, trembling, reached out, and when he touched the casket, he screamed. A screech owl flapped out of the box into our faces, scaring us and covering us with Paris green. Doodle was paralyzed, so I put him on my shoulders and carried him down the ladder. And even when we were outside in the bright sunshine, he clung to me, crying, "Don't leave me! Don't leave me!" When Doodle was 5 years old, I was embarrassed having a brother that age who couldn't walk, so I set to teach him. We went down to Old Woman's Swamp, and it was spring, and the sick, sweet smell of bayflowers hung everywhere like a mournful song. "I'm going to teach you to walk, Doodle," I said. He was sitting comfortably in the soft grass, leaning back against the pine. "Why?" he asked. I hadn't expected such an answer, so I won't have to haul you around all the time. "I can't walk, brother," he said. "Who says so?" I demanded. "Mama, the doctor, everybody." "Oh, you can walk," I said. And I took him by the arms and stood him up. He collapsed onto the grass like a half-empty flour sack. It was as if he had no bones in his little legs. "Don't hurt me, brother," he warned. "Shut up. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm going to teach you to walk." I heaved him up again, and again he collapsed. This time he did not lift his face up out of the rubber grass. I just can't do it. Let's make honeysuckle wreaths. Oh, yes you can, Doodle, I said. All you've got to do is try. Now come on. And I hauled him up once more. It seemed so hopeless from the beginning that it's a miracle I didn't give up. But all of us must have something or someone to be proud of, and Doodle had become mine. I did not know then that pride is a wonderful, terrible thing. A seed that bears two vines, life and death. Every day that summer, we went to the pine beside the stream of Old Woman Swamp, and I put him on his feet at least 100 times each afternoon. Occasionally, I too became discouraged because it didn't seem as if he were trying, and I would say, Doodle, don't you want to learn to walk? He'd nod his head and say, and I'd say, well, if you don't keep trying, you'll never learn. Then I'd paint for him a picture of us as old men, white-haired, him with a long white beard, and me still pulling him around in the go-kart. This never failed to make him try again. Finally, one day, after many weeks of practicing, I stood him alone. He stood alone for a few seconds. When he fell, I grabbed him in my arms and hugged him, our laughter pealing through the swamp like a ringing bell. Now we knew it could be done. Hope no longer hid in the dark palmetto thicket, but perched like a cardinal on the lacy toothbrush tree, brilliantly visible. Yes, yes, I cried, and he cried it too, and the grass beneath us was soft and the smell of the swamp was sweet. With success so imminent, we decided not to tell anyone until he could actually walk. Each day, barring rain, we sneaked into Old Woman's Swamp, and by cotton-picking time, Doodle was ready to show what he could do. He still wasn't able to walk far, but we could wait no longer. Keeping a nice secret is a very hard thing to do, like holding your breath. We chose to reveal all on October 8th, Doodle's 6th birthday. And for weeks, we mooned around the house, promising everybody a most spectacular surprise. Aunt Nicey said that, after so much talk, if we produced anything less tremendous than the resurrection, she was going to be disappointed. At breakfast on our chosen day, when Mama, Daddy, and Aunt Nicey were in the dining room, I brought Doodle to the door in the go-kart, just as usual, and had them turn their backs, making them cross their hearts and hope to die if they peeked. I helped Doodle up, and when he was standing alone, I let them look. There wasn't a sound as Doodle walked slowly across the room and sat down at his place at the table. Then Mama began to cry and ran over to him, hugging him and kissing him. Daddy hugged him too, so I went to Aunt Nicey, who was thanks praying in the doorway, and began to waltz her around. We danced together quite well until she came down on my big toe with her brogans, hurting me so badly I thought I was crippled for life. Doodle told them it was I who had taught him to walk, so everyone wanted to hug me, and I began to cry. What are you crying for? Asked Daddy. But I couldn't answer. They did not know that I did it for myself. That pride, whose slave I was, spoke to me louder than all their voices, and that Doodle walked only because I was ashamed of having a crippled brother. Within a few months, Doodle had learned to walk well, and his go-kart was up in the barn loft. It's still there, beside his little mahogany coffin. Now, when we roamed off together, resting often, we never turned back until our destination had been reached, and to help pass the time, we took up lying. From the beginning, Doodle was a terrible liar, and he got me in the habit. Had anyone stopped to listen to us, they would have sent us off. My lies were scary, involved, and usually pointless, but Doodle's were twice as crazy. People in his stories all had wings and flew wherever they wanted to go. His favorite lie was about a boy named Peter who had a pet peacock with a 10-foot tail. Peter wore a golden robe that glittered so brightly that when he walked through the sunflowers, they turned away from the sun to face him. When Peter was ready to sleep, the peacock spread his magnificent tail, enfolding the boy gently like a closing go-to-sleep flower, burying him in the glorious, iridescent, rustling vortex. Yes, I must admit it, Doodle could beat me lying. Doodle and I spent lots of time thinking about our future. We decided that when we were grown, we'd live in the Old Woman's Swamp and pick dog tongue for a living. Beside the stream he planned, we'd build us a house of whispering leaves, and the swamp birds would be our chickens. All day long, when we weren't gathering dog tongue, we'd swing through the cypresses on the rope vines, and if it rained, we'd huddle beneath an umbrella tree and play stick frog. Mama and Daddy would come and live with us if they wanted. He even came up with the idea that he could marry Mama and I could marry Daddy. Of course, I was old enough to know this wouldn't work out. But the picture he painted was so beautiful and serene that all I could do was whisper, "Yes, yes." Once I had succeeded in teaching Doodle to walk, I began to believe in my own infallibility, and I prepared a terrific development program for him. Unknown to Mama and Daddy, of course. I would teach him to run, to swim, to climb trees, and to fight. He, too, now believed in my infallibility. So we set the deadline for these accomplishments less than a year away, when it was decided Doodle could start to school. That winter, we didn't make much progress, for I was in school and Doodle suffered from one bad cold after another. But when spring came, rich and warm, we raised our sights again. Success lay at the end of the summer like a pot of gold, and our campaign got off to a good start. On hot days, Doodle and I went down to Horsehead Landing, and I gave him swimming lessons, or showed him how to row a boat. Sometimes we descended into the cool greenness of Old Woman Swamp and climbed the rope vines or boxed scientifically beneath the pine where he learned to walk. Promise hung around us like the leaves wherever we looked. Ferns unfurled and birds broke into song. That summer, the summer of 1918, was blighted. In May and June there was no rain and the crops withered, curled up, then died under the thirsty sun. One morning in July, a hurricane came out of the east, tipping over the oaks in the yard and splitting the limbs of the elm trees. That afternoon, it roared back out of the west, blew the fallen oaks around, snapping their roots and tearing them out of the earth like a hawk at the entrails of a chicken. Cotton balls were wrenched from the stalks and lay like green walnuts in the valleys between the rows, while a cornfield leaned over uniformly so that the tassels touched the ground. Doodle and I followed Daddy out into the cotton field where he stood, shoulders sagging, surveying the ruin. When his chin sank down onto his chest, we were frightened, and Doodle slipped his hand into mine. Suddenly, Daddy straightened his shoulders, raised a giant, knuckly fist, and with a voice that seemed to rumble out of the earth, began to curse everything from the weather to the Republican Party. Doodle and I, prodding each other and giggling, went back to the house, knowing that everything would be all right. And during that summer, strange names were heard through the house. Chatu Terry, Amines, Sessions. And in her blessing at the summer table, Mama once said, "And bless the Pearsons whose boy Joe was lost at Belleau Wood." Those are World War I battle sites in France. So we came to that clove of seasons. School was only a few weeks away, and Doodle was far behind schedule. He could barely clear the ground when climbing up the rope of vines, and his swimming was certainly not passable. We decided to double our efforts, to make that last drive and reach our pot of gold. I made him swim until he turned blue, and row until he couldn't lift an oar. Wherever we went, I purposely walked fast, and although he kept up, his face turned red, and his eyes became glazed. Once he could go no further, so he collapsed on the ground and began to cry. "Oh, come on, Doodle," I urged. "You can do it. Do you want to be different from everybody else when you start school?" "Does it make any difference?" "It certainly does," I said. "Now come on." And I helped him up. As we slipped through dog days, Doodle began to look feverish, and Mama felt his forehead, asking him if he felt ill. At night, he didn't sleep well, and sometimes he had nightmares, crying out until I touched him and said, "Wake up, Doodle, wake up." It was Saturday noon, just a few days before school was to start. I should have already admitted defeat, but my pride wouldn't let me. The excitement of our program had now been gone for weeks, but still we kept on with a tired doggedness. It was too late to turn back, for we had both wandered too far into the net of expectations and had left no crumbs behind. Daddy, Mama, Doodle, and I were seated at the dining room table having lunch. It was a hot day with all the windows and doors open in case a breeze should come. In the kitchen, Aunt Nicey was humming softly. After a long silence, Daddy spoke. "So calm. Wouldn't be surprised if we have a storm this afternoon." "I haven't heard a rain frog," said Mama, who believed in signs as she served the bread around the table. "I did," declared Doodle, "down in the swamp." "He didn't," I said contrarily. "You did, eh?" said Daddy, ignoring my denial. "I certainly did," Doodle reiterated, scowling at me over the top of his iced tea glass, and we were quiet again. Suddenly, from out in the yard came a strange croaking noise. Doodle stopped eating with a piece of bread poised ready for his mouth. His eyes popped round like two blue buttons. "What's that?" he whispered. I jumped up, knocking over my chair, and had reached the door when Mama called, "Pick up the chair, sit down again, and say, 'Excuse me.'" By the time I'd done this, Doodle had excused himself and had slipped out into the yard. He was looking up into the bleeding tree. "It's a great big red bird," he called. The bird croaked loudly again, and Mama and Daddy came out into the yard. We shaded our eyes with our hands against the hazy glare of the sun and peered up through the still leaves. In the topmost branch, a bird the size of a chicken, with scarlet feathers and long legs, was perched precariously. Its wings hung down loosely, and as we watched, a feather dropped away and floated slowly down through the green leaves. "It's not even afraid of us," Mother said. "Looks tired," Daddy added, "or maybe sick." Doodle's hands were clasped to his throat, and I had never seen him stand still so long. "What is it?" he asked. Daddy shook his head. I don't know, maybe it's..." And at that moment, the bird began to flutter, but the wings were uncoordinated, and amid much flapping and a spray of flying feathers, it tumbled down, bumping through the leaves of the bleeding tree and landing at our feet with a thud. Its long, graceful neck jerked twice into an S, then straightened out, and the bird was still. A white veil came over its eyes, and the long white beak unhinged. Its legs were crossed, and its claw-like feet were delicately curved at rest. Even death did not mar its grace, for it lay on the earth like a broken vase of red flowers, and we stood around it, awed by its exotic beauty. "It's dead," Mama said. "What is it?" Doodle repeated. "Go bring me the bird book," said Daddy. I ran into the house and brought him the bird book. As we watched, Daddy thumbed through its pages. "It's a scarlet ibis," he said, pointing to the picture. "It lives in the tropics, South America to Florida. A storm must have brought it here." Sadly, we all looked back at the bird. A scarlet ibis. How many miles it had traveled to die like this in our yard beneath the bleeding tree. "Let's finish lunch," Mama said, nudging us back toward the dining room. "I'm not hungry," said Doodle, and he knelt down beside the ibis. "We've got peach cobbler for dessert," Mama tempted him from the doorway. Doodle remained kneeling. "I'm going to bury him." "Don't you dare touch him," Mama warned. "There's no telling what disease he might have." "All right," said Doodle, "I won't." Daddy, Mama, and I went back to the dining room table, but we watched Doodle through the open door. He took out a piece of string from his pocket, and without touching the ibis, looped one end around its neck. Slowly, while singing, "Shall We Gather at the River," he carried the bird around the front yard and dug a hole in the flower garden next to the petunia bed. Now we were watching him through the front window, but he didn't know. His awkwardness at digging made us laugh, and we covered our mouths with our hands so he wouldn't hear. When Doodle came into the dining room, he found us seriously eating our cobbler. He was pale and lingered just inside the screen door. "Did you get the scarlet ibis buried?" asked Daddy. Doodle didn't speak, but nodded his head. "Go wash your hands, and then you can have peach cobbler," said Mama. "Not hungry," he said. "Dead birds is bad luck," said Aunt Nicey, poking her head from the kitchen door, "especially red dead birds." As soon as I had finished eating, Doodle and I hurried off to Horsehead Landing. Time was short, and Doodle still had a long way to go if he were going to keep up with the other boys when he started school. The sun, gilded with the yellow cast of autumn, still burned fiercely, but the dark green woods through which we passed were shady and cool. When we reached the landing, Doodle said he was too tired to swim. So we got into the skiff and floated down the creek with the tide. Far off in the marsh, a rail was scolding, and over on the beach, locusts were singing in the myrtle trees. Doodle did not speak and kept his head turned away, letting one hand trail limply in the water. After we had drifted a long way, I put the oars in place and made Doodle row back with the tide, against the tide. Black clouds began to gather in the southwest, and he kept watching them, trying to pull the oars a little faster. When we reached Horsehead Landing, lightning was playing across half the sky, and thunder roared out, hiding even the sound of the sea. The sun disappeared, and darkness descended, almost like night. Flocks of marsh crows flew by, heading inland to the roosting trees, and two egrets, squawking, arose from the oyster rock shallows and careened away. Doodle was both tired and frightened. And when he stepped from the skiff, he collapsed into the mud, sending an armada of fiddler crabs rustling into the marsh grass. I helped him up, and as he wiped the mud off his trousers, he smiled at me ashamedly. We had failed, and we both knew it. So we started back home, racing the storm. We never spoke. What are words that can crack pride? But I knew he was watching me, watching for a sign of mercy. The lightning was near now, and from fear he walked so close behind me he kept stepping on my heels. The faster I walked, the faster he walked, so I began to run. Rain was coming through the pines, and then, like a bursting Roman candle, a gum tree ahead of us was shattered by a bolt of lightning. When the deafening peal of thunder had died, and in the moment before the rain arrived, I heard Doodle, who had fallen behind, cry out, "Brother, brother, don't leave me, don't leave me." The knowledge that Doodle and my plans had come to naught was bitter, and that streak of cruelty within me awakened. I ran as fast as I could, leaving him far behind with a wall of rain dividing us. The drops stung my face like nettles, and the wind flared the wet, glistening leaves of the bordering trees, so I could hear his voice no more. I hadn't run too far before I became tired, and the flood of childish spite evanesced as well. I stopped and waited for Doodle. The sound of rain was everywhere, but the wind had died, and it fell straight down in parallel paths like ropes hanging from the sky. As I waited, I peered through the downpour, but no one came. Finally, I went back and found him huddled beneath a red nightshade bush beside the road. He was sitting on the ground, his face buried in his arms, which were resting on his drawn-up knees. "Let's go, Doodle," I said. He didn't answer, so I placed my hand on his forehead and lifted his head. Limply, he fell backwards onto the earth. He had been bleeding from the mouth, and his neck and the front of his shirt was stained a brilliant red. "Doodle! Doodle!" I cried, shaking him. But there was no answer but the ropey rain. He lay very awkwardly with his head thrown far back, making his vermilion neck appear unusually long and slim. His little legs, bent sharply at the knees, had never seemed so fragile, so thin. I began to weep, and the tear-blurred vision in red before me looked very familiar. "Doodle!" I screamed above the pounding storm and threw my body to the earth above his. For a long, long time, it seemed like forever, I lay there crying, sheltering my fallen scarlet ibis from the heresy of rain. And that's the end of the story. I wish we could talk about what the story means and why it must be read, and how important family is, and how important the weak ones are, and all those kinds of things. But we can't. But your students need to hear it. Because they're so mean to their siblings. Literature. What makes literature good? I'm going to run across this list very quickly. Now I'm going to switch it up. Keep your list. It was very good for you. We're going to talk about, it's a brief outline of what we're going to do, but I'm going to illustrate these points then with outside things from the story. I shouldn't have made you try to fill that out while you're doing the story. That's just too much. But hopefully it gets your mind going. You can kind of have this as something to fall back on. The best stories, I believe, are the stories that are true. The stories that are true to us. We live and react in a real world. Like, things are very real to us. So we need stories to be effective. They need to be real to us. And they need to be real in a reality. One way to do that is by appealing to our senses. And that's why I'm saying that, so 1A, how did this story appeal to our senses? What did you see, taste, smell, feel, and hear? There were many things in that story. The one sentence, in fact, at the beginning, "The last graveyard flowers were blooming, and their smell drifted across the cotton field and through every room of our house, speaking softly the names of our dead." There we get to smell those flowers. We get to hear the names of our dead. We get to take things in with our senses. God created us with those five avenues. Our stories need to appeal through those five avenues. There's no other way you're going to touch a person. And then, a story is true, a good story, if it appeals to our desires. What desire would you say was in the Scarlet Ibis? One of the desires that humans have. We have. I'm human.
To succeed.
Success. Good.
Love.
Love. You say acceptance. He was fighting for all those things. What are some fears? What fears did this story appeal to? Kind of the opposite of some of those. The fear of having a brother who was insane. Or the fear of having someone that was just a burden all their life as part of our life. not real fears. Another little tidbit. Let me hold up this book, The Mighty Ones by Manner to Jong. If you're not familiar with Manner to Jong, get familiar with it. The best author from middle grades that I'm familiar with. And here's a little excerpt from Appealing to Our Desires from his book. He writes books more, not stories. Shadrach. There was this little boy, Davy, and he was going to have a rabbit. His grandfather had promised it. A real, live rabbit. A little black rabbit, if possible. In a week, if possible. And this was the Netherlands. See, even right there, the desire to have a little black rabbit, your own. It's appealing. It's appealing to their desires. That's why a story needs to appeal to desires that we have. Appeals to our fears. Let me read. I've got so many things I want to read here. This is a story by an eighth grader I once had. Now, this eighth grader was slow. Probably the slowest student ever taught. Not only was there that issue, there was a language barrier. There was awkwardness on every level. And then beyond that, there were honesty problems. It was a tough case. And at the school, we also had, we dealt with an honesty issue. We dealt with various things. And she had to write stories. And I got this nice little piece of paper from her, all folded up like this, taped shut. And she didn't want to give it to me. Like, she was too embarrassed. And it says on the front, here's my story. This is not my actually story. Doesn't count. This was a draft she had scribbled up. She then wrote another story. But you ought to go find that first draft. There's a reason. And I don't want to just expose her soul. None of you here know her. And I don't think the recording will have a way of finding its way back. But, very dear girl, listen to this. There was a boy whose name was Job. He was very fat, weighing 200 pounds. He would always fall out of his bed in the morning. He could not sit on very soft things. After he got up off the floor when Job was ready to go to school. Sorry about the punctuation, those kind of things. At the breakfast table, he would eat 20 pancakes and drink 10 cups of milk. The school bus would come around 8 o'clock to his place. He would be waiting out there. The door of the school bus would be 6 feet wide. When he would go into the whole bus would shake a bit. Then all the children would laugh out loud. Then the bus driver would tell the children to be quiet. In school, he would sit in his chair, and the chair would be about to break. For recess, Job plays outside with all the other children. Recess snack, Job would eat 5 apples. He does run fast, even though he is plump. If he would tag someone, you would know for sure you were tagged because you would feel it. That year at school, we were having debates, people not saying they were caught when they were caught. You would never ask if he was caught or not, if you were caught or not. When lunchtime comes, Job is very hungry. In his lunchbox, he would have 5 sandwiches, 2 yogurt containers, and 3 oranges. He would get this down in 15 minutes. The children in school do laugh at him. If he is being bugged too much, he will take the children and give them a slap. Or sometimes he would take them and sit down on their legs or arms. The children would yell and scream. If this got enough, the teacher would take an action by scolding them. At the end of the day, some children would have to take a note home to their parents. The parents would read it and then scold them. Method of punishment they used that year. And after that, they had to go say sorry to the teacher and to Job. The next day would come, and the student would have to say sorry to the teacher and Job after devotions. The children with a note would have to come to the front of the classroom, and each would say they were sorry. The teacher would say, "You may be seated." The next day would come and be a lot better than yesterday, but this did not hold out long, and they would all start over. Then one day, Job's father, and just to summarize the rest of the story, Job's father comes in and gives devotions and says, "You need to be nice to each other," and they have a thing, and the issue is resolved. The story spoke so much to me because I suddenly saw the heart of the girl, her fears and her desires. She felt like she was never accepted, and she wanted to be accepted. And so when she went to write a story, it just all came out. It's a good illustration of a story appealing to our fears or desires. We tend to sometimes write that way, even though we don't know it's happening. That year also I had a whole set of students that were way below average in height. And a short book to read at story time, Incident at Hawks Hill by Alan Eckert. And it's about a little short boy that got lost in the Kansas prairie. It's based on true fact, and a badger took him in. Those students loved that story because there was that fear, there was that desire in them that they could identify with a main character. What are some mechanics or intricacies of a good story, or just the nuts and bolts? And I feel like, first of all, we need to deal with what is known. We need to write about the things we know. There are great writers like Tolkien and Lewis and those kind of people that can write wonderful stories about things they imagine, but your students can't. Like, discourage them. Make them write about the things they know. Manu Tajong, by the way, pick up this book. I'm going to talk about it later. What has gone into this book? Three things. There was my first teacher, a massive storyteller, who from the first day of my schooling told me in the class the mighty tales from the Old Testament. We sat listening to him, and we sat like rocks in the stillness of suspense and absorption. Nothing must escape us. Then there was my grandfather, and enchanted by my interest in books, he taught me to read even while the teller of the mighty tales was still teaching us our ABCs. He taught me by having me read to him from the Bible, hour upon hour, evening after evening. And thirdly, all this was happening in Wirum, the village of my birth. It was a fishing village, and the fishermen were as vivid, violent, and picturesque as were the Bible tales told by my teacher and led me and read me by my grandfather. There are these three, inextricably, inevitably bound together, culminating in a book of Bible stories as I have heard, read, and lived them as a child. And Manuk Jung writes about Holland, the things he knows. Write about the things you know. Do you feel like the Scarlet Ibis, the James Hirst, knows what he's talking about? Yeah. And the reason, part of the reason why you need to write about things you know is you can write about specifics then. He knows how the palmetto fronds and all those things looked. Old Woman Swamp, when I'm reading it, I'm there with him. And I would have no idea how to write about a nice swamp. I might be able to write about the inside of a silo, or I might be able to write about some other things that are part of my experience. So your students need to write out their own experience. They want to write about someone who lived far away in old days and stuff. And there's a place for that, but not too much. So deal with what is known. Use figures of speech. That was all through that story. And nice allusions. I feel like I'm adding things in my notes so much. But there was that one section in there that said they had wandered too far into the net of expectations and had left no crumbs behind. So you see the allusion to the old nursery tale about Hans and Gretel and how they left the crumbs behind. These fellows left no crumbs behind. So when you allude to something else, you begin to stand on the shoulders of that other work, and our minds go back and make connections, and we really enjoy it. Another thing with allusions, if you notice the whole way through the Scarlet Ibis, he was talking about the casket. And it started out with the wind speaking the names of our dead. You knew what was coming, or you kind of felt it, even if you didn't know it. And it built that suspense, that connectedness the whole way through. Figures of speech. Start with a problem if you want to create a good story. It needs to start with a problem. Listen to this. Manu Tajong in the book Along Came a Dog. The dog had no name. For a dog to have a name, someone must have him and someone must love him and the dog must have someone. The dog had no one and no one had the dog. The dog had only the silent, empty countryside of a few houses. The dog had only the crumbs and cleaned bones he could pick up at the few houses. The dog had only himself, so the dog had nothing, and he was afraid. Hunger haunted the dog. It sat like agony back in his eyes. Hunger ached out of his ladder-rack ribs, those lean ribs that threatened to break through the stretched, shivering skin. Always the dog shivered. When at rest, he shivered, not from cold necessarily, but from hunger, from fear, from loneliness, and from lovelessness, mostly perhaps from lovelessness. For the dog had nothing but himself. I wish I could read you more. We can't. Got to hear the last line. But now, in the last few weeks of this stray year, the little dog had added a house to another road on his nightly rounds. So he'd go around looking for bones. The house where two people lived with a toothless, rheumatic old hound. The hound was too toothless to gnaw his bones, too old and weary with life to bury his bones. But still the old hound obeyed his dog instincts and shoved his bones under an old burlap bag against the wall of a shed where he lay during the day, sunning his rheumatic joints. And the little dog knew. I like it. There's a lot of good things for a good story in there. In the exactness of, like, the details of actually having a rug and having just little intricate things. They make the story live for us. So start with the problem, then you need to carry on with the problem. You need to sustain the suspense in the story, or people might lay it down after the first paragraph. We have till 4 o'clock, am I correct? Okay. People might lay it down after the first bit. You need to sustain the suspense. In The Scarlet Ibis, there was suspense sustained well through there, along with the interestingness that held our attention. But problems build on problems. And it's a good thing. If you're a bad boy in school, are you going to get into more trouble or less trouble as the year goes on? Trouble always gets worse. It's a good thing for story writers because you start with one problem and then that leads you into another problem. And good stories can build suspense that way. The best story for building suspense is content, a short story, Contents of a Dead Man's Pockets. I'm guessing some of you have read that. For Jack Finney, it's where the man's letter goes out the window and he steps out to get it. And he's however many floors above the street. And your hands just sweat and sweat and sweat. Just, it never ends. It gets worse and worse. And then finally when he makes it back to the window falls down in front of him. And he can't get back in. It's like just the suspense just rolls and rolls. It makes a good story. A little nitty-gritty about intricacies of good story, correct grammar and punctuation. Makes a world of difference. Students need to hand in stories that are edited well. Periods and commas and capital letters and spelling. I give my students 1% off for every punctuation spelling mistake. They know that. So there's a red pen down across there, and you just start with 100, and you, or whatever grade you think the thing deserves, like quality-wise. So give it a 96 quality-wise, and it goes down fast. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and you can soon get a bad grade. It's an easy way for them to just get a better grade by punctuating. Care about it. Finally, the ending. End well, but not moralizingly. I don't have a whole lot for stories that are like the Aesop fables, that at the end they tell you why you should never do this again. I feel like The Scarlet Ibis did that well. Winnie the Pooh, Christopher Robin does that well when he says this after the heffalump. So, you know, Piglet went running home and said, heffalump, right? And took Christopher Robin out, and all it was Pooh with the honey pot over his head. Poor Piglet is so embarrassed. It says, there, said Piglet, isn't it awful? And he held tight to Christopher Robin's hand. Suddenly Christopher Robin began to laugh, and he laughed, and he laughed, and he laughed. And while he was still laughing, crash went the heffalump's head against the tree root. Smash went the jar, and out came Pooh's head again. Then Piglet saw what a foolish Piglet he had been, and he was so ashamed of himself that he ran straight home and went to bed with a headache. But Christopher Robin and Pooh went home for breakfast together. Oh, Bear, said Christopher Robin, how I do love you. So do I, said Pooh. Just nice comforting ending. We don't need a moralizing lesson, but make it clear at the end of the story. How can you have students write this way? We need to diverge a little bit from the description to talk about how you can make your students write that way. A good thing, why I'm waving this book around, The Mighty Ones, is because I like to read stories out of this to my students. These are Bible stories. So he takes Noah's Ark, Old Testament stories mainly, takes Noah's Ark and talks about how it would have been, like it's a story, like the Bible is. And the village women are so worked up because there's been noises in the night and they're sure they saw an alligator walk down their street and into that boat Noah built. It's terrifying. And you begin to actually see what it would be like. And little beautiful twists, like the two swans were coming in for the ark and the one hit a tree and broke its wing. And so they stayed out there and the ark door wasn't going shut because the last animals weren't in until the water came up enough. The swans with the broken wing and the other one lifted up the broken wing swan and they swam together over to the ark and walked up in. And I don't think it happened that way at all. But it makes the story come alive. You see, this isn't just a Bible story. This is a story too. Where I'm going with that is have your students write those stories. You have the Bible story of David and Goliath here already for you. You have all the work done, a plot, your characters, actually the events that happen. All you need to do is make it just in our language or as we would understand it. And your ninth grader 2 years ago, sit down and take that story, and he has Noah's David and the bears, and he has David out there sitting on a rock and the lambs jumping around him and he's holding it and having fun with it, and the little coney is peeking out of his hole over here in the side. It's really good because the writer entered into the story and created a story that we as readers can enter into as well. Make them use their senses to listen to what comes in the story. I feel like I am over time. I heard two bells. Questions you have, just... we don't have time. Clarifications. Or corrections. Is there anything? Do you have something?
I was just wondering how you... it's not framed yet. Go ahead.
Anyone else?
Could you have
of which? Oh,
yeah, and I'm probably saying it wrong. It's not Frank. I've been fighting these things this whole time, haven't I? I think they actually don't like me because they work sometimes and sometimes they don't. That's the small kids' tea. Have you heard the book, The Wheel on the School, Shady Rack, Singing Hill, Along Comes a Dog, Hurry Home Candy? These are excellent books for middle graders. If you try to read it to upper graders, they're going to get a little bored. I read my 5 to 10 Hurry Home Candy, and they all enjoy it. That's actually the book about the dog that I started out with. They actually enjoy it, but it's very simplistic. And one of the best, as far as a writer that I could say, I think everything he's written is well done and for lower grades. Are there any other authors in here? Because that's good news for all of us. Stories that you really feel like should be read, or authors for middle graders. Someone you would hold up.
Lewis B. Miller.
Lewis B. Miller. Is that the Hardy Boys? No, not the Hardy Boys. The Fort Blocker Boys?
Yeah.
Okay. Lewis B. Miller. More.
Well, some I read, like the Lamplighter Theater books.
Mm-hmm.
I like they're in the old, like an old setting, but they teach very good lessons.
Right. So Lamplighter series. Christie's Old Oregon, is that one of them? And
like Sir Malcolm and the Prince.
Okay. Those are good. I kind of stick with a lot of classics when I read. I talked about Incident at Hawks Hill is a good one. Again, there's editing in all these. I think we all know that. Banner in the Sky by James Ramsey Ullman. That's a must read. Words by Heart by Sebastian O. Something is another terrific book.
I was wondering about the practical application for writing in the classroom. How often do you do it? Is it an everyday write a paragraph thing, or how do you do it a lot?
How do you do writing? I remember there was an old guy around here the other year, and he said students every day should write, draw, and sing. And then he said, but I don't know how we would do it. I don't have a good answer for that. I generally stick pretty close to the composition lessons in the English books. And like the reading book sometimes gets them with Rod's staff curriculum. Another good thing that brings up, I wish I could talk about, but talked about it last year and wasn't sure how much to overlap, and that is accumulative sentences. So start a sentence with just a clause and then add more onto it. And I have a whole list of them, but I think things start out there at 410 or something. I've got a nice list that my students put together if you want to think about what I'm talking about. Thank you all so much.